is State versus Stephen F. Schiffermiller. Mr. Kosmicki, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Matt Kosmicki. I represent Stephen Schiffermiller in this matter. On June 6th of 2016, Stephen Schiffermiller was contacted by police after a report of two people fighting in the street. Once police arrived, he was immediately handcuffed, set on a curb. He remained handcuffed for an hour and was told he could not leave. Eventually, police determined that they did not have enough facts to support if an assault had occurred. And instead of releasing Schiffermiller, they decided that they needed to figure out where he could go, and they continued his detention for nearly an hour. They ultimately decided to take him to his parents' home, and before entering the police car, he was searched, and almost simultaneously by two officers, and was found to have brass knuckles and then a flashlight, which was then opened, and inside the flashlight was found marijuana and prescription pills. Mr. Schiffermiller argues that the Court of Appeals erred in three ways.
Does it make any difference in which order those items were discovered?
Not necessarily. The prescription pills, they were in a container, and so they, you know, the law requires that they have to be in a prescription bottle with his name on it. So they were, it violates the law in that way. I think what I was trying to point out was that they were found. He was searched at the same time by two different guys, and they were found. I think Officer Dean said that I found the brass knuckles first, but within 10 seconds or whatever, Officer Eilicker found the flashlight and then opened it and found the...
So even if the officer couldn't have, by the feel, known that the pills were there, already the brass knuckles
had been
detected by feel and
had been detected by
then
feel.
Then you get
yes.
into the search incident
right.
to arrest and
right.
all
he'd
of that.
Patted him and you could tell.
I apologize for stopping the flow of your argument.
No, that's okay. That's all right. Getting my roadmap there. We argue that the Court of Appeals erred in three ways: that the detention was a permissible Terry type stop, and a tier two contact; that the community caretaker exception was so broadly applied past what an automobile, like in Bakewell and in Katy, and that the subsequent search was not reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
What is your best argument that this went beyond a Terry stop?
Well, it's a long one. sorry. Well, the Terry stop. This wasn't an arrest because it was, or a Terry stop because it wasn't brief. It was intrusive. It was an unreasonable use of force. He was immediately, I can't remember which one got there first, but I think it was Officer Eicher, but it doesn't matter. The first officer on the scene immediately put handcuffs on him, set him on the curb. And at that point, they had a report of an assault. They see him, his shirt's torn. He's got blood on his knuckles, I think they said. But they have nothing else. And then they quickly look around and they look for, I think two other officers show up. So totally you have four officers. Searching. I think it's an excessive show of force. Many officers control handcuffs, physically handcuffing him and setting him on the curb and telling him for an hour he can't leave. I know that the Court of Appeals in the state had cited two cases where even though it's a Terry stop, force can be used. And that case, the main Nebraska case, is State versus Wells. But I think Wells is factually distinct from this case. In that, in Wells, you have a trained narcotics officer who's in an area where there is known drug trafficking. He knows that people who are selling drugs or trafficking drugs usually have a weapon, some type of weapon. He sees activity, looks like shorthand, hand-to-hand sales going on. He approaches Wells. He knows Wells. Wells is in a car. While he's coming up to the car, Wells is digging in his pockets and then has one hand inside of his coat. We look at these Fourth Amendment things on a case-by-case basis, and in that circumstances, it was reasonable for that officer to think that Wells was reaching for a gun. And so that's when that officer took him out and handcuffed him. Well, had to, I think they put him on the ground and then handcuffed him. That's not present here in this case. You don't have all those factors that support something's going on, or at least that there's a weapon involved, or could be.
What does the record tell us about when, in these course of events, the officers became concerned about potential intoxication by alcohol or drugs?
It's towards the end. I think the record says for the first 30 or 40 minutes, they're trying to decide if there's some kind of assault that happened. They couldn't locate the other person. What I'm pausing on is I'm trying to remember if they went door to door or not and knocked on people. I mean, this is kind of housing close to Tierra Park, so there was a park there. So I think they kind of looked in the park area to see if they could locate someone. But then towards the end, they say they spent the last hour. You know, this is all rough estimates, too. I mean, I think that they gave, but, you know, the last 20 minutes or so trying to figure out what to do with Schiff and Miller because they thought that, you know, he could be intoxicated or under the influence of something. And that's when they, you know, they were talking with him, where would you go? He wanted to leave. And
what should they have done?
I think they should have let him go.
Couldn't they have taken him into custody? Public intoxication, disorderly conduct.
But they had no evidence that he was intoxicated. I mean, they thought that he was, and that's it. It was just sheer speculation.
So they should have done field sobriety?
Field sobriety test, at least at a minimum of PBT, right? This isn't a DUI where you're going to wait 15 minutes. They could have just, you know, simply just given administered a PBT, and you'd know that there was at least alcohol present.
Would drugs have shown up on a PBT?
Drugs would not have shown up on a PBT. The odor of marijuana would have, that they found in the flashlight. They didn't ask him if he took any prescription medications, though. I think that they were so concerned about either whether he's under the influence or a mental health issue or some kind of physical, you know, from an actual assault, whatever happened, it'd easily been called medical in to just rule out of those things. But, you know, they didn't do any of those things. It was just, we think he's under the influence. They didn't do any investigation, even just an inquiry whether he was under the influence.
So a medical evaluation. So take him to a hospital, have him checked out,
or have LFR come there and have the at least you know the ambulance come and check him out. I mean that happens a lot.
If they would have done either one of those things, take him to the hospital or had LFR come there, would they have conducted a pat down search before they either transported him or had LFR have contact with him?
I don't know if they've done that. I mean I didn't ask them that during the motion suppress. I can tell you based on experience they don't. Before they do a DUI investigation, a lot of time they'll bring people in and have LFR show up and, you know, check them out, and they don't pat them down then. They only pat them down when they're going to put them in the car after they're arrested. So I think there's a lot of factors that support that. I mean, I think it's factually distinct from Wells. The Court of Appeals also looked at a case, U.S. versus Jones, and listed a bunch of factors, the number of police cars and police officers that are involved, nature of the crime, reason to believe the suspect is armed, strength of police, articulable and objective suspicions, erratic behavior or suspicious movements, need for immediate action by the police, or lack of opportunity to make a stop under less threatening circumstances. Those factors also aren't here to justify the use of force like was used here, which is, well, obviously I'm talking about force of putting the handcuffs on and sitting them on the curb. I'm into my rebuttal time. I'll reserve the rest.
Thank you very much. Mr. List, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. We agree with the Court of Appeals' decision in this case. We maintain that the detention of Mr. Schiffermiller, the pat-down of Mr. Schiffermiller, and the subsequent search of the flashlight were all lawful. As far as the detention, we agree with the Court of Appeals that the initial portion of the detention was justified as a permissible Terry stop. And then after the initial criminal investigation into the assault concluded, the remaining portion of the detention was justified. And while they were trying to figure out what to do with Mr. Schiffermiller, that portion of the detention was justified under the community caretaking exception.
Caretaking exception in Nebraska has usually been related to people found in a motor vehicle, correct?
It has been, typically, correct.
And what would justify the expansion of that in this situation?
Even looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Katie, I mean, it dealt with it also in the context of the automobile exception. But I don't think there's any basis to limit it solely to that context. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Katie itself explains that this is totally divorced from a criminal investigation on the Fourth Amendment. It's grounded in the safety of the individual, of officers, or the public at large. it's grounded in the safety of the community, not just regulation of vehicles or protection of vehicles. I mean, safety is the overarching concern, so I don't see why we would limit that solely to vehicles and say, well, we don't care about anything else other than vehicles if safety is that overarching concern. In our brief, we cited a number of other federal and state court decisions that have found it doesn't apply solely to automobiles. We agree with those decisions. And then just briefly, I would also note that at least to the extent we're talking about the continued detention in this case, for the sake of argument, even if it applies solely to automobiles, we disagree with that notion. But even if it does, he had a vehicle at the scene. And they confirmed it was, in fact, his vehicle. So for the sake of argument, if automobile or community caretaking does apply solely to automobiles, we had that here, at least for purposes of detention. So we maintain the detention here in its entirety was justified and lawful. As far as the pat-down, we maintain that it was also warranted under the community caretaking exception. The community caretaking exception does authorize seizures as well as searches, provided that the actions taken are reasonable. We submit that it was here based on all of the circumstances. The officers were simply not comfortable leaving Mr. Schiffmiller alone or letting him go in light of all the information known to him. And as a safety precaution, they felt that it was necessary to pat him down prior to transporting him in a police cruiser. We don't see anything unreasonable about that. So we would submit that it was pat down was justified and lawful. And then finally, as far as the search of the flashlight, we would submit it was justified as a search incident to arrest once the brass knuckles were found during the pat down, which we maintain was lawful.
Is I'm trying to parse a phrase that you used. Community caretaking would justify a seizure, and thereafter community caretaking would justify the search. Is that a fair statement?
The pat-down?
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
In that order?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, you could have independent basis for a pat-down as well, but I think the community caretaking exception would justify it in these circumstances.
We have said that the community caretaking exception is to be applied narrowly. I'm sort of hearing you articulate that it really is a case-by-case analysis, which is, it's hard to articulate a limiting principle. But if we were to attempt to articulate a limiting principle, what is the state's view of what that should be?
Well, I think you already have articulated a limiting principle by noting more than once that it is to be applied rare and in exceptional circumstances. So,
but that doesn't tell trial courts what those circumstances are. It just says do it narrowly, and we're not going to tell you any more than that.
Sure. I guess in my mind, it really comes into play. If you're talking about seizures or searches under the Fourth Amendment, you're really only going to find yourself in your caretaking if you don't have some justification in the criminal context. I mean, because typically that's where it's going to be. And that's why we don't really find ourselves even having to get into this very often. But to me, that's really going to be the only justification for going into that. Or perhaps you have some sort of independent, medical circumstance that might take you under exit circumstances rather than a true investigation. But to me, that's the limiting principle, is that you don't have some other broader or investigative justification, and you truly have nothing more than a circumstance or a set of circumstances that present you with a significant safety concern.
Judge?
Does or should our jurisprudence dictate if an officer is going to rely upon the community caretaking exception, how they should proceed? In other words, Mr. Kosmicki has suggested there were other things they could or should have done. Should we delve into that?
Well, I mean, that's tough to articulate, so I'm not really sure what I would propose there and how you would articulate that. I mean, I would note that even in Katy, the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledged the fact that they didn't need to do that search and articulated the fact that this could have been done in a less intrusive means in the abstract doesn't mean that what happened was unreasonable. So it's... Especially with it being fact-specific, it's hard to lay out some sort of protocol in terms of when this is going to apply, let alone how exactly you should go about doing this.
Is the community caretaking exception at all similar to the emergency aid exception that the Supreme Court has recognized to warrantless entries to homes when there is some sort of emergency inside?
I think it is somewhat similar. I think the distinction there is going to be the emergency.
Is there a limiting principle in that body of jurisprudence that might be helpful?
Well, perhaps you're referring to something I'm not aware of, but I guess my general understanding of that is going to be that the emergency provides that exigency, which of course is going to allow you to proceed without a warrant under the Fourth Amendment. Here, I think it's a bit different because you may not have that emergency or that exigency, but you still have officers having a legitimate concern of safety and a legitimate concern with figuring out what to do with the situation. And in a case such as this, letting them go just doesn't seem reasonable at all. What they did seems perfectly reasonable in light of the facts and circumstances here.
Is there, you mentioned that this is likely to be invoked when there isn't a criminal investigative purpose that the officers can identify. So with that notion in mind, is there a danger then that the community caretaking exception would be used to say, you know, we want to investigate this, but we don't have much, but we're from the government and we're here to help you, and that's a basis to take further action?
Well, sure. I mean, that's always going to be a concern. I mean, you don't want officers being, you know, just running around and going up to people and saying, hey, I'm going to just pat you down. I don't know if you're dangerous. But there, we still have the guiding principle of reasonableness. I mean, any action they take, whether it's in the context of criminal investigation or in community caretaking, it's going to have to be justified. I mean, if you're making a stop, it's going to have to be justified. If you're making a detention, it's going to have to be justified. A search is going to have to be justified. I mean, sure, it might be independent of a criminal investigation, and so your basis for doing that might be a bit different and even perhaps innocuous, but it still is going to have to be justified. It's not going to be enough to just go up and say, hey, we're law enforcement. We're
like that. Do you think it would be jurisprudentially prudent to have a protocol that the other avenues would need to be exhausted prior to a seizure and thereafter a search? In other words, when you're, for example, roughly like this case, and the officers see somebody who may be in distress, you know, say call for medical, or if that's not feasible, then proceed with community. Is there?
I mean,
and none of the obvious Fourth Amendment exceptions were otherwise available.
My hesitation to commit to that, I mean, I don't necessarily have a problem with it, but my hesitation to commit is that oftentimes you might have officers thrown into a situation where they're just not sure what's going on, and say it truly is hectic. I mean, it's just chaos. Are you really going to sit there and pull out a card and be like, well, we got to go through our protocol here. Let's rule out criminal investigation. If you truly have somebody who's in distress, maybe you just act first.
But they are ruling out other obvious Fourth Amendment exceptions. I mean, that's a trained officer would be going through that, no doubt, right? Can I seize this individual?
Well, sure, right. I mean, they obviously need to be
assessing
and
that
the facts.
Doesn't occupy a lot of time to a trained officer, does it?
I'm sorry?
As I wouldn't occupy a lot of time for a trained officer to say, gee, is there a Fourth Amendment exception that applies, right? Can I seize this individual? I mean, I understand things can be hectic in the field. I don't want to ignore that.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not if I could finish.
You may.
I'm not disagreeing with the notion that generally speaking, we should not be in the arena of something else if we're going to be in the arena of community caretaking. I guess I'm just, as I said, I'm just hesitant to, at least on behalf of the state here, without having something more concrete in mind, I'm hesitant to articulate a protocol.
I'd like to follow up on Justice Papik's question about the interrelationship between a criminal inquiry and a community caretaking inquiry. It seems to me there are three possibilities: that there never was a criminal question at all, that there was a criminal question at the outset that morphs into community caretaking, or the reverse. It starts as community caretaking and then progresses the other direction. Should our analysis vary at all depending upon which one or ones of those three possibilities are involved?
I don't think so, since reasonableness is going to be the guiding analysis there, and for the most part, as I've read everything, the analysis really is virtually the same. I mean, even if you're in the community caretaking rather than, you know, criminal investigation, it's still going to be basically the standards of reasonable suspicion. If you stop for, you know, for the detention, and probably something higher for a search. But I guess that might be the only place where it would matter, where, like when I look at Katie, it does seem like they didn't quite require as high of a threshold to search that vehicle, that it was just, hey, this posed a safety concern, and that we didn't really do a kind of a heightened probable cause analysis there. So in that regard, yes, it might matter, because if you're starting with criminal and it converts to community caretaking, you're going to have a higher threshold to start with there before you can just convert it. Whereas if it's community caretaking, yeah, the standard might be a little bit different. And if it morphs into criminal, the standard might change. So I probably need to think that through further, Your Honor, but yes, I think it might change.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, so in this specific situation, we are facing basically three aspects of analysis: the original investigation, the continued detention, and the searches that occurred during that continued detention. Would you agree with that?
Yes. So for further questions, we ask you for the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 55 seconds, Mr. Kosmicki.
Before you go, do you agree with the question that I just asked Mr. List, that those are three aspects we're looking at here?
Yes, I agree.
All right, thank you.
The community caretaker exception, the Katie case, Katie versus Dabrowski, and then the U.S. versus King case, I want to point out that in those cases, there was at least some articulable facts that there was some threat to the public and to the officer. In Katie, the case, the Wisconsin Police Department was arresting a Chicago police officer for a DUI. They were concerned because they thought that Chicago officers are required to have their firearms on them at all times. They were going to leave, so they wanted to search that car to make sure they weren't leaving a car with a firearm in it. And so that's where that community caretaker exception started from. In King, there was an accident. There was a car honking excessively. There was damage in the road. The officer went up to the car and said to King, hey, there's damage out here. You can't go through the intersection. Stop honking while she's talking to him. So she's not contacting him for any kind of investigation for criminal activity. But when she looks in the car, she sees a gun on his side, holstered, where apparently in New Mexico, you can have a gun on your person. That's okay. But she's concerned about that, what that threat posed to her and to the public for a gun. So she orders him out of the car. There's a chase, and drugs and stuff were found. In the other cases cited by the state and by the Court of Appeals, like U.S. versus Riddow, they've come up on, it's outside of a vehicle, and most of the cases, like I said, involve automobiles. But in Riddow, there's a person in the middle of the road, officer drives up, sees a guy out in the road in the middle of the night. They flash him, he's acting weird. They see, or they get out to talk to him, he may be intoxicated. But when asked for ID or some questions, he backs away and makes actions like he's, which a reasonable, prudent person would think he's reaching for a gun. Then they grab him and contact him. Can I finish?
You may.
There is some kind of articulable or some facts that support there is some kind of threat to either officer or the public. That's not the case here. So I respectfully ask that you find that the Court of Appeals erred like the District Court, and that our motion to suppress should have been sustained, and that the evidence should have been suppressed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.